The events of 1967 to 1974 were traumatic, defining moments in modern Greek history. They defined a generation, their outlook on the world, and their views at home. The legacy of this period would change Greece. Indeed, for some, the demand for change would crystallize a victory over the system that produced the colonel's junta. Decades later, the questions and debates remain. The what-if questions, the accusations, the conspiracy theories. What kept the junta in power? Who was responsible for the debacle in Cyprus? What options did Greece have after Turkey invaded the island? What did Turkey know or hear? What role did Washington, and in particular Henry Kissinger, play and why? There is a complex story behind this historical tragedy, and our guest today is well suited to tell it. Alexis Papahelas has published a new book, An Askotinoi Dhamatio, In a Dark Room, that recounts the events of 1967 to 74. It combines high-quality investigative journalism with painstaking historical research over some 25 years or more. The author has examined archives, interviewed many of the key protagonists, and discovered critical audio tapes. To Greeks in our audience, Alexis Papahelas will need no introduction. He is the doyen of Greek journalism today. He straddles TV and the press with his current affairs program on Sky TV and his role as editor-in-chief of Kathimerini, the leading quality newspaper in Greece. Previously, Alexis has published two books. The first, The Rape of Greek Democracy, examined Washington's role in junta politics, and November the 17th investigated the notorious terrorist organization. We're truly delighted to host him today. Today's event is organized by the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics, and I am the director of the observatory. It's my great pleasure to welcome everyone. Shortly, I'll invite Alexis to say a few words to introduce his book. I'll then follow with some questions of my own, and we'll invite you, the audience, to send us your questions. You can send us your questions using the Q&A facility at the bottom of your Zoom screen, or if you're watching on Facebook, you can do so using the comments facility on Facebook. We also invite you to send us your comments using Twitter, and we suggest the #LSEGreece. Let me also point out that today's event is being recorded, and all being well, we hope to make it available for a podcast and download from the web pages of the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics. So let me get us underway and invite Alexis Papahelas to introduce his new book. Alexi, welcome. You're muted at the moment, Alexi.
I'll give it another try. I usually have my daughter assist me in these high-tech things. Well, Kevin, thank you very much for this very kind invitation. I also want to thank everybody at the Observatory for setting this up. Let me talk about this book. I mean, my first book was about the US involvement in Greece from the 50s up to 1967, The Rape of Greek Democracy. This is kind of a sequel to this. It has to do with the period from 67 to 74. It's something that this research started maybe 20, 25 years ago. I first got involved in a documentary about the Cyprus events of 1974. It was something that really struck my curiosity, my imagination, perhaps, when I was a young teenager in Greece, and I was witnessing all these incredible things happening around me. The coup against Makarios, the epistrateψη, the general mobilization, the rumors that Greece was going to go to a war with Turkey. I remember driving around the suburbs and seeing hotels turn into hospitals. And this became, for my generation, which was a highly politicized generation here in Greece, it was kind of a big unknown. It was a big mystery. You know, what really went on? Were there any secrets that, you know, should have been revealed, you know, at some point? So I really started digging into all this. some years ago, as I said. I was lucky enough because back then it was much easier to do work for documentaries on TV, for example. So I started interviewing people who are still around, like Bülent Ecevit, the then Turkish Prime Minister, James Callaghan, the Foreign Affairs Secretary back, you know, in 74, and also a lot of people in Greece, people who are in the background or in the foreground. And I also, because I was a correspondent in the US, I was lucky enough to meet a lot of the people who were actually dealing with the Cyprus crisis and the Greek events from 67 to 74. These were State Department diplomats, there were analysts for the State Department, there were some former Greek-American or non-Greek-American CIA agents. Very tough to unlock in some ways. I mean, it took, you know, quite a bit of work to have them sort of tell their story. And it was, for me, really intriguing, because the more I dug into this, the more I realized that there is much more to be discovered. I also looked into the archives, of course. This was a period that coincided with the Clinton administration, and there was a real effort by some people in the State Department to be much more forthcoming in responding to freedom of information requests. So again, I was a bit lucky because a lot of stuff came out then, because people, especially a couple of the people who were involved with the classification process, were really determined to go against the bureaucracy and the deep state in Washington and have some of these things come out. And there were some pretty damning things about the role of the US and Kissinger and others. Now, the book has to do basically with two periods. One is 67 to 73. This is the period of the when the junta in Greece is solidified, the king leaves after a failed coup. The US is initially reluctant to have a warm relationship with the Greek junta. But then as Nixon comes in, as Kissinger becomes the czar of foreign policy in the US, there's kind of a realpolitik setting in. And the US, you know, becomes more and more involved in supporting the junta. This leads to its, it's sort of a climax when the then Greek-American vice president comes to Greece, Spyro Agnew, a guy who resigned in disgrace, of course, later on. And this is kind of the honeymoon, the golden century of U.S.-Greek relations in the mind of the then, you know, powers that be in Washington. The Pentagon people, the CIA people, love the junta. They have incredible access to them. They have U.S. facilities in Crete and all over the place. They have this wonderful dream to have a U.S. carrier permanently based in Phalerio, where my office is, you know, visible to any Athenian. And also, you know, Greece becomes very, very important in 73, when there is a Middle East crisis, and all of a sudden the U.S. needs any kind of facility in the area. And this is the time when they realize that Greece is critical. That's when Kissinger says that, you know, we cannot really live without Greece, so we don't really care if there's a junta or a democratic government there or anything else. Then the book goes into the dynamics between Papadopoulos, who from a colonel in the army, an intelligence fellow with very close relations to the U.S. intelligence services, becomes kind of a regular politician. He's completely in bed with the Greek business establishment. That kind of enrages the younger generation of junior officers, who are much more nationalistic, much more idealistic in some ways, and they become increasingly angry with him for compromising on the values of the so-called revolution. Their hero is Dimitris Ioannidis, who is a much more provincial character than Papadopoulos. He's a guy who really believes in the Megali Idea, the great idea of expanding Greece into various territories of its historical past. He's a guy who very much believes in the enosis with Cyprus, since he served there and he absolutely hated Makarios. And he is the guy who finally overthrows Papadopoulos when he tries to open up the regime. He tries this democratic experiment with a new government. Then the Politecnio happens, the student riots, and then the government's overthrown. Ioannidis takes over. this coincides with the period when oil is actually discovered in the Aegean. Ioannidis has all these illusions of grandeur, rather, that Greece will become like the Qatar or the Kuwait of the area. He kind of ignores the Turkish reaction to all of this. And he tries to play a diplomatic game with the US, claiming that, you know, if they don't support him in this, if they don't support him in a possible confrontation with Turkey, he will move towards France, which is kind of interesting and very apropos in the current Greek context. And then, you know, we go through a very turbulent spring in 74. Greece and Turkey come very, very close to a war because of the Aegean, not because of Cyprus. And then Ioannidis decides to move against Makarios. There is the coup. There is the Turkish reaction. There is the U.S. involvement. And all this comes to a real climax on July 20th, when Turkey invades Cyprus. There's been a big question mark in everybody's mind here. Why is that Ioannidis didn't do anything to prevent this? Why didn't he take any defense measures and so on? One of the new things that come out of this book, besides talking to a lot of the protagonists and a lot of the people around Ioannidis and around Kissinger and Etzebeth, of course, himself, is the minutes and the actual audio recording of an infamous war council that was convened on the morning of July 20th, as Turkey was actually invading Cyprus. And there it's really amazing to see that Ioannidis is completely caught by surprise. He still has this delusion of a double enosis, and he thinks that Turkey will be absolutely fine with that. He says something to the effect that let them take, you know, a small part of Cyprus, and then maybe, you know, we'll strike a deal or something like that. And this is very chaotic. I mean, it's depressing. It's almost, I don't know. I mean, it makes you very angry if you're, you know, a Greek to listen to this, because there's complete chaos, complete disarray. And one thing that's very apparent to everybody is that, you know, this guy, this central character, has either been deceived by the Turks or the US or, you know, by his own delusions. And at the same time, he has ignored any kind of institutional mechanisms or anything like this that, you know, like the intelligence services, like the military services. There's nobody really present at this table except for him and a couple of, you know, C characters who pretend to be the prime minister and the ministers and so on. And this goes on, you know, describing basically the implosion of the junta, because the junta was overthrown by the generals in reality, but also was a complete implosion. Ioannidis kind of faded into the sunset. I mean, he completely lost his nerve. He contemplated the war with Turkey. He actually gives an order for the enosis with Cyprus, and then he takes it back. He gives an order for war with Turkey, and then, you know, this never happens. And he also gives an order for Greece to leave NATO, which, again, never materializes. For me, this is an incredible episode of Greek history. Karamanlis comes in. The US, of course, has kind of predicted that. Kissinger predicted this a couple of months before it happened. Karamanlis faced a very tough situation, which was twofold. One is how to avoid another coup, and also how to deal with the Cyprus issue without being characterized as a prodoti, you know, not to be accused of treason and all that. And he's really stuck, because he realizes very fast that there's no military solution that his generals can, you know, sort of suggest to him. But he's really worried that if he doesn't do anything, he's basically going to be overthrown within a few days after his return from Paris. And this is a very interesting chapter. In the end, he decides to withdraw from the military part of NATO, because that's the only kind of safe thing to do at the moment in order to channel public anger to, you know, some in some direction. And then you have a few more months of background involvement of the US with Kissinger, who feels very... Nixon resigns, Ford comes in, Ford faces incredible reaction from the Greek-American community and the Liberal Congress. They accuse Kissinger of being behind the Cyprus invasion. They blame him for the support of the junta. He faces all the consequences of his own policy towards Greece in the years past. And he tries to strike a deal. he becomes very desperate in that respect. He's almost apologetic, you know, trying to strike a deal. And of course, nothing happens because neither Makarios nor Karamanlis nor anybody else are willing to legitimize the invasion at that point. The wound was like too fresh to deal with it. In a nutshell, you know, what's the book? That is what the book is all about. And, you know, of course, as you said, and the book is based on two things. One is documents from mainly the U.S. Archives, and also from interviews with a lot of people who either played a major role, like Ecevit and others, or they played a secondary role next to Ioannidis, next to others. And sometimes, you know, their story is more important than the official story that, you know, the main characters prefer to remember. So that's what the book is all about. And as you know, journalists are kind of people who try to write history in a hurry. But I think, you know, 25 years gave me the luxury to look at things, you know, from a distance. And I think that this is a pretty, I would say, objective, history of what happened. There are, of course, a lot of dark corners in this dark room, which I don't know if I will ever find the answers to. And my sense is that this will never be found in a cable that has not been declassified. And this is probably, you know, the answers, people like Ioannidis, took them to their graves, was probably a conversation with a Greek-American CIA agent or something like that, things that we would never really discover or be able to, to find out about. I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you, Alexei, very much indeed. That's a great introduction and overview. Let me endorse the point that it is full of extensive documentary evidence and interviews. Indeed, also interviewed transcripts between some of the protagonists at the time. So very, very well documented history. And I'm sure young academics who might be watching this can see that this is a book which can spur many PhDs and research projects, etc. So in that respect, it's a very valuable resource. Let me begin by asking some questions, if I may, Alexei. And in a sense, I hesitate to ask questions of Greece's leading TV interviewer, but nevertheless, let me give it a go. Perhaps simply to start off with a bridge between your previous book, The Rape of Greek Democracy, and this book, In a Dark Room. I wonder if you could just give some comments on how the junta managed to stay in power for 7 years, not from the foreign or international relations perspective, but from the domestic perspective. Perhaps you'd like to comment, you define yourself as part of the polytechnic generation, part of the 1974 generation, etc. Why did it take 6 years before there was a protest?
Well, that's a very good question, Kevin. And I think part of the answer is that people were very tired of the turmoil that occurred before the junta. You remember there was a prolonged crisis from basically 64 to 67. And I think people were kind of disillusioned by, the way the political system was working itself out. The monarchy had completely failed in dealing with the crisis. It had completely lost its legitimacy, and up to that point was kind of a pillar of stability, disliked by a lot, but still it was, considered kind of a serious institution. It lost any kind of aura, of that nature. And also, I think people were like very, it's hard, I don't know what word to use, but they became very cynical, I think, actually. The junta was maybe lacking in a way because this was a period of economic growth. This was a period where, and the junta basically managed to, in the first couple of years, cut through a lot of their red tape, strike their own deals. Of course, sometimes with the profit sharing addendum that would never find out. But there were things happening. There were investments coming to the country. The economy was growing. And it's interesting to me because, you know, people started getting really angry around 73, not only because they were very tired, of course, of the, of the oppression and everything, the censorship and everything else. But I think they were also, they started getting very angry when the oil crisis started, prices started going up. There was a financial crisis that hit the Greek stock market around then. And that's when the middle class really started reacting to the junta. The other reason was that there was a complete failure of the establishment. The military establishment, which was, you know, to some extent legitimate. Of course, they were all anti-communist, they were all pro-Western, but they were not necessarily on the junta side. I'm talking about the generals, the admirals, and so on. They completely failed to react. I mean, I'll never forget an interview that Patakos gave me when he said that the first day of the coup, if somebody had basically, given a push, a nod, they would have fallen. You know, the whole, coup would have fallen apart. But nobody did that because the king was incredibly immature and inexperienced. The generals and the military establishment basically didn't do anything. They were just scared. They were just, cowards. And I think this lasted for quite a while in the military. Again, in 73, when things, come to a peak, the military reacts. We have the famous Navy coup, which was the first serious challenge of the junta from the inside. And in my view, was the beginning of the end. So the answer, I think, is, people being tired, people being cynical, but at the same time, I think that people were really lost any faith in the establishment, the monarchy, the military establishment, and so on. And one last thing, if I may say something, one of the things that, really is an undercurrent in Greek history, especially modern Greek history, is this metaphysical role sometimes we assign to the great powers. And of course, the great powers, the UK, the US, they played a very significant role. They really meddled in our own affairs and so on. But, sometimes this role we assign them becomes a rationale for lack of action. And I think a lot of the business community, the intellectuals and others, they were saying, there's nothing we can do if the Americans like the junta. Still would do something.
Okay. Perhaps then if we can come directly to the period covered by the book. You begin the book with a story about Ioannidis, who is the final head of the junta before the Cyprus debacle. We're going to come on to the Cyprus debacle in a moment, but you begin the book with a story about Ioannidis coming into your apartment building. Do you want to just tell us about that?
Yeah, this is an interesting story, but by coincidence, I live in an apartment building and his sister was living a floor above us. And of course, this was, the junta, not too many questions were asked. And we had no idea who the invisible dictator was. I mean, there was this rumor, as a kid, saying, this new guy, Ioannidis, nobody has seen him, nobody knows what he looks like. And there was this guy, sometimes he was wearing a uniform, sometimes he was in civilian dress. He looked really intimidating, but very polite. And whenever he would come into our building, there was a civilian car with some guards outside. We had no idea who this guy was. And then one day, I remember a relative brought in Newsweek. This was late 73. And Newsweek had a picture of Ioannidis saying, he's the invisible dictator of Greece. And of course, my father, to his horror, realized that, this guy was, the guy was visiting the lady upstairs, our neighbor. Then we found out that there was her brother. And for me, this was, quite amazing. I remember everybody in the building, we talked to other neighbors and all this. We stopped listening to BBC, I think, or we're doing it, in a very low-key manner. And for me, the incredible thing is that the end of the book happens in the apartment above where I was living, because the last scene of his downfall is when he goes to the apartment, his sister's apartment, and he talks to somebody. We don't know to this day who that is. And he comes out and says, It's all finished. It's all gone. I'm resigning. That's it. And for me, you know, the fact that, you know, the last scene of this drama occurred in a place where I was living is kind of, you know, maybe a sign from God that I should, you know, do some research on this.
It's a great story, absolutely. So perhaps we can focus on Ioannidis and his role. Of course, one of the great contributions of your book is the discovery of the audio tape of the War Council meeting. Let me just explain that this is a War Council meeting of the junta, which takes place as the invasion of Cyprus by Turkish forces has already taken place. And therefore, it's a discussion as to what Greece should do in response. And you emphasize that the discussion shows the junta in disarray. You're shocked by the discussion. You emphasize that the decision to launch the coup in Cyprus, to bring down President Makarios in Cyprus, is made by Ioannidis. And you emphasize how different a character Ioannidis is from his predecessors and others in the junta system, as it were. You describe him as a solitary nationalist. You've mentioned now his support for Enesis and the Megali Idea, etc. So without Ioannidis, would there have been no Cyprus debacle? And without Ioannidis, do you think the junta could have carried on for some while yet?
Well, my sense is that had it not been for Ioannidis, it would have been somebody else, another major or another colonel. I think there was a lot of dissatisfaction within the army because Papadopoulos became the guy who was living in Onassis's villa. I mean, this is kind of anathema to a young captain or major, you know, who thinks of himself as a revolutionary against the establishment. Also, Papadopoulos very, very quickly compromised on Cyprus. He's the guy who pulled out the Greek troops, the Greek division from Cyprus under U.S. pressure. He's the guy who, even though initially he tries to assassinate Makarios or get rid of him, in the end, he compromises and they have a very, very easygoing modus vivendi going on. So I think that, you know, if it was not for Ioannidis, it would have been somebody else. Now, Ioannidis is exceptional in the sense that he is incredibly provincial. He's incredibly brutal in his ways. He has no sense of foreign policy or diplomacy or anything else. He's very secretive because his whole life is involved in conspiracies and intelligence kind of work. And he's a guy who's really trapped in his own megalomania and his own, you know, ideas of, you know, how to deal with things. And for me, it's just incredible that, you know, to the events leading up to the invasion of Turkey, there's so many people who go and tell him, the Turks are going to go in, do something about it. You know, there are intelligence people, Greek military people, even the then British ambassador, you know, tells him that. I mean, this great story when, you know, he actually, in a very rare occasion, even though he refused to see the U.S. ambassador, he accepted to see the U.K. ambassador. And the guy comes in and says, listen, you know, I live in the house of Venizelos. Yes, I'm a British diplomat, but I love Greece. Every day when I come down from my bedroom, I see Lord Byron's portrait. I love this country. I'm going to retire. I want to stay here. Please do something because the Turks are going to invade. And Ioannidis comes back and says to the officers in his office, you know, this guy really impressed me, you know, with his love for Greece and all this. And he really kind of destabilized him because, you know, he was telling the Turks are going to invade. And then, of course, you know, he adds, well, he's a Brit, so I don't trust him, which, you know, kind of shows his mentality.
Yes, it's not a topic I would like to dwell on, but in terms
Sorry,
of trusting,
trusting the Brits. Sorry about your needs, yes.
Trusting the Brits, but so your point is that if it wasn't Ioannidis, someone else in the junta might have decided to invade Cyprus, yes? Or how distinctive is Ioannidis in this respect, then?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of what ifs. If we go back and say, yes. Okay, what if Papadopoulos had not been overthrown by Ioannidis. He had succeeded in some sort of transition into a semi-democratic regime or rule. Yes, maybe in that, you know, case, I think the Cyprus episode could have been avoided, because I really think that Ioannidis played a role. He was so blinded, he was so angry about Makarios, that he couldn't really see anything else.
Okay, and it was a huge strategic mistake. As you say in the book, there was no way that Turkey was not going to invade Cyprus after a coup d'etat. Previously, the Turkish armed forces had felt that they had been required to be too soft, or to not to be interventionist enough. And you mentioned that this is a gift for Bülent Ecevit, the Turkish prime minister, who you don't characterize as being perhaps the best brains around in the region. So it's a gift for Turkey, and they invade. But then you criticize the junta for those 3 days after the invasion has taken place, that the junta decides not to take military action. And you criticize them because you feel that although a Greek intervention at that immediate stage would not necessarily have led to some militarily different outcome, but it might have brought the United States to intervene in a more fulsome fashion. And then with US intervention in this imbroglio, the outcome on Cyprus might have been more favorable for Greek Cypriots and Greece. And you refer to the silence of the Greek arms at this respect. What I'm struck by is that that is a very strong logic, a very convincing logic. If I could just momentarily jump forward to August of 1974 and the second offensive that is launched by Turkey, wouldn't the same logic have held, that Karamanlis, if he had decided to intervene at that stage, wouldn't, again, Washington have decided we don't want a Greco-Turkish war at any cost, and the configuration might have ended in a more favorable outcome. So why condemn Ioannidis' passivity in the first 3 days and not condemn Karamanlis in August?
Okay. There are three different answers for three different periods. One is Ioannidis before the invasion. When he falls into the trap, he actually believes that he could let the Turks take a small part around the landing location, around Kyrenia. And then he thought that he could strike a deal for a Dublin Osses. And we know that this was a trap set up by the Turks, and that Kissinger helped in this, because there's this famous cable that comes from Turkey, and then the US also sends the same message, saying that the Turks will not open fire after they land on Cyprus unless the Greeks fire first. And this explains the silence of the Greek army for the first period. So this was a terrible mistake, because there was no mobilization, there were no measures taken, there was nothing. I mean, basically, people who were actually on the landing ground there working for Greek intelligence describe it as kind of a parade, you know, by the Turks. So that's one. The second is the invasion starts. And actually, the first 3 days go pretty badly for the Turks. The Turks complain to Kissinger, Ecevit complains to Kissinger that the Greeks are sending Greek ships with Turkish flags. Kissinger communicates with the Greeks, and he says, well, if you see them, sink them. And they actually sink them, but they're Turkish ships. Also, you know, the landing is going very slowly. They have serious problems despite their air superiority. So the three or four first days were critical. And Kissinger says this to Nixon in a phone call from DC to California, where he says, the Greeks are fighting better than we thought. The CIA head, Colby, says, the Turks are terrible in this. They're really screwing up this invasion, this operation. God forbid if they had to fight, you know, for NATO or something like that. And therefore, those 3 days was a critical window where, you know, if Ioannidis had sent some reinforcements, or if there was a serious kind of coordination of the resistance against the Turks, A, it would have made a difference on the ground. I'm convinced about that from all the things I've read. And the second, I think that, you know, Kissinger would have been much more alarmed, because his big thing was not Cyprus. I mean, he says like 10 times, and the CIA guys also say the same, we don't give a damn about Cyprus. All we care is we don't want a war between Greece and Turkey. We don't want a division of NATO. We don't want the Soviets jumping into this. And they were very worried about the Soviets doing that. So Hadi Ioannidis, who was considered an unpredictable, irrational player, given the order, and the order, you know, had actually been executed to either send, you know, the planes or even, you know, a flotilla of actual Greek ships, not Turkish ships with Greek flags, etc. Then, you know, I think Kissinger and Nixon, even though he was at his, you know, sort of the last days of his presidency, would have been much more alarmed. Because what happens here, there's kind of a narrative, you know, I mean, there's like all these threats and all this bluffing by the Greeks, especially by Ioannidis, that never materialized. And at some point, Kissinger says, oh, don't worry about the Greeks. You know, they're barking, but they're not going to do anything. So that's the second period. The third period is Karamanlis. Now, Karamanlis comes in. He has no idea whether he controls the military. He doesn't know these people. He has Averov as his defense minister, who basically convinced a war council. And the best these guys can come up with, they say, okay, we can send some planes, but we're not sure, you know, it's going to work, because if we send them, we don't know if the Aegean is going to be safe, if there's going to be another you know, war front that's going to open up. And then they say, what we can do is we can send a flotilla down to Cyprus with reinforcements. And they have this brilliant, you know, sort of footnote that says, we can do this even though we have no air cover, you know, to move them from Greece to Cyprus. But we can only do it if the U.S. Sixth Fleet is going to guarantee safe passage, which is kind of insane. I mean, why would the U.S., you know, do that after, you know, they've seen what happened on the ground? So I think Karamanlis comes to the conclusion that this is going to be a very high-risk operation. He doesn't want to take a chance because he doesn't have a clear picture. He doesn't trust these people. The military has also messed up the mobilization in the meantime. And more importantly, in the first 3 or 4 days, the Turks have managed to solidify their bridgehead in Cyprus. So they're much stronger than they were before. Now, if Karamanlis had decided to, which he came very close to doing actually, to embark on a, you know, on a ship and to head a flotilla, you know, a symbolic flotilla towards Cyprus, saying that, you know, I do this for the honor of Greece and I call upon the Western powers, you know, to intervene. Yeah, I mean, it might have worked, but it was so high risk and so irrational in that context that, you know, I think everybody around him, you know, told him basically, don't do it. I mean, he later on claims in a meeting he had with Ford, he said that day, the day of the second Turkish invasion, was the worst day of his life, because he had to decide between protecting the Greek honor and basically settling for what happened. And he said, you know, I had no other choice, but it was a real humiliation for me. And I think, you know, that really reflects his own feeling.
Yeah, and the book gives the transcript of that discussion that Karamanlis had, and the advice to not to to go there. I think the intention was for the Prime Minister and Averov to go on the boat to the ship to Cyprus. Would you also then, by the same token, excuse Karamanlis for his decision that Greek forces should respect the UN ceasefire, even when the Turkish forces were not?
Well, this happened in two parts. One was the during the Hunda days. Actually, the critical part, I would say, happened during the Hunda days. And some of it happened during the Karamanlis period. No, I think that's something that, you know, could have been prevented, let's say. I mean, there was some plans to send some reinforcements and do exactly what the Turks were doing in a limited kind of fashion. I think what prevailed there was, one, they weren't quite militarily ready for that. I mean, there's this famous story when they had some ships in Piraeus ready with some tanks and some troops, and then they realized that the only landing dock they could do this was in Famagusta, which was threatened by the Turks, and they couldn't do it in Paphos, which was a safe thing to do. So I think it was that, plus there was some sort of diplomatic calculation that Greece had to appear as being the good guy in that this was going to help Greece and Cyprus in the aftermath.
Okay. If we just momentarily come on to the US role more directly in this story. One of the revelations in your book is that the CIA station in Athens actually had some of the senior members of the Greek armed forces on their payroll. And presumably the intention was to influence leaders of the junta in that fashion. So why do you think the Washington didn't do more, the CIA do more, to actually stop the instigation of the coup against Makarios? They had the potential to do so.
First of all, I think the preparation for the coup against Makarios was very tightly held. It was Ioannidis and a couple of people around him. Not a couple, there were about 10 people around him. He intentionally kept out of the process the head of the Air Force and the head of the Navy, because they had suspicions that they were talking to some US diplomats or agents or whatever. And this was a very, very tightly knit kind of operation. And it was kind of a cabal of people, that were very tight-lipped about what happened. There's another thing here. I mean, when I talked to these people, they said, these guys were our friends. They were our comrades in the war against communism. We never thought of, these people as targets of an operation or something like this. So I don't think they ever, thought of, surveilling Ioannidis or one of his people to actually find out what happened. And I think what they did, obviously, and they admit this openly, both in my interviews and in some of the documents, is that then they had a very, very elaborate covert operation to prevent Ioannidis from going to war against Turkey. Mm. How did they do this? First of all, they influenced some of the generals and the admirals and so on, who said, this is a stupid idea, we will not do it. Secondly, they had this whole disinformation campaign saying that there are Soviet troops amassing on the border with Bulgaria, and that somehow a second front was going to open up, which was going to split up Greece into two. So they used every effort in order to pacify the Greek military establishment and also basically to pull the rug out of Ioannidis in terms of this specific thing.
Okay, and in the book, you're very condemnatory of Henry Kissinger. You emphasize his cynicism in relation to the events of 74 and in general in relation to the geopolitics of the Eastern Mediterranean. I take your point that in the book you criticize his short-sightedness, and I can see the point about short-sightedness. The relevance here is that Kissinger is advised that by his actions or inactions, he's inflaming the prospects of anti-American sentiment in Greece, and this could have a long-term consequence for U.S. interest in the region. And Kissinger, you quote, coming back saying the State Department is not a political science department, which I thought also was a very interesting metaphor to use. But I wonder whether, given that Kissinger was a realpolitik practitioner par excellence, I wonder whether his cynicism is actually the right word. His analysis, his diagnosis was right, wasn't it, in relation to the overall geopolitics. What he missed was the long-term consequences. So it was short-sightedness, but cynicism. I wonder if that's too harsh.
Well, it depends how you read Kissinger. I mean, if I were Niall Ferguson, perhaps I would say he was the master of realpolitik. I mean, he was the Metternich of his day. If I'm on the receiving end of this as a Greek, then I think, you know, I can say that he was, you know, cynical. And that he also messed part of this up. I mean, one thing that impressed me was how, like, you know, the whole bureaucracy from Joe Sisko down was telling him the Cyprus crisis is brewing. Do something about it. Make sure, you know, you get your hands on this and all this. Send a cable, do this, do that. And, okay, he had the excuse of Watergate. I mean, the guy was praying with Nixon on his knees, obviously. So that's a big excuse and a valid excuse. But for me, it's amazing that he never paid attention to any of this kind of warnings. And then in all the postmortems, he tries to rationalize this by saying, well, yeah, that was nonsense. It was some guy in the bowels of the department telling me something. It was not really important. Sense, yeah, okay.
I can't actually believe that Kevin is trying to defend Henry Kissinger, but let's move on and let's assume.
No, you say you're going to play the devil's advocate.
Absolutely.
I usually do the other.
Let's turn to the UK. Do you think the UK simply made itself irrelevant because it was following slavishly the line of Washington? I think Callaghan tells you in response to one of your questions that he decided it was wise not to discuss Cyprus with Henry Kissinger and Washington. And you have an interesting story about Callaghan and a milk float. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, when I met Callaghan, he was telling me that the night that Henry, as he called Kissinger, called him up to tell him about the Turkish invasion, it was like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and he rang up the Foreign Office to send him a car, and they said, well, we don't have a car available right now, we'll get it in half an hour or something. And he was so eager to get in his office that, you know, he came down from his apartment building and he flagged the milk van, and of course, you know, in all modesty, he says, I was recognized around the country then, so the driver recognized me, took me to the Foreign Office, which I thought was kind of a very British way of introducing the rest of the story. And he says, I mean, basically, Callaghan, I think, described the limits of British power, because he said that after Suez, we had realized that we couldn't really take the initiative on a thing like this. And even though, on the one hand, you know, he had ownership of this because this was Cyprus, you know, a British colony, part of the Commonwealth, and, you know, with a very complicated British history behind it. I think, you know, at some point he wanted to do something more activist, let's say, in order to either prevent it or to strike a deal in Geneva. But he couldn't do it because, of course, this was a very unstable time in British politics, as you know, too. So he didn't really have a clear grip on this. And then Kissinger had kind of made very clear the limits of what, you know, the US would support and what, you know, they wouldn't. And anytime he thought of using the threat of using military force against the Turks, when, for example, they approached the airport, the old airport in Nicosia, or in a couple of other occasions, Kissinger is very clear, you know, telling him, you know, you're not doing this. If you do it, you're going to be on your own. And that's the end of the story. So he's kind of a tragic figure. I mean, he's kind of a, you know, somebody who tries to play the traditional British role, but he realizes, you know, in reality, the very limits of that.
There are legacies there today. Let's go to the questions from the audience. And I'm just going to take these directly. Our mutual friend, Professor Dimitris Sotiropoulos from the University of Athens, asks a question: at what point do you think that Ioannidis accumulated more substantive power than Papadopoulos, and why did this happen? Secondly, will you write a third book, that is, on the events after 1974?
The answer to the second question is, I don't know. I'm not sure I'll have the courage or the time to write another book. We'll see. I mean, I have a couple of things in mind that I'm working on, but I don't know. It's too early to tell, really. Now, Ioannidis, I think, accumulated a lot of power basically after, I would say, 71, 72. This is when Papadopoulos and his people, his entourage, are completely seduced by the establishment. I mean, they rather go to nice parties at the villas around Athens. They have no real sense of what's going on in society. They have no real control of the actual army, because Papadopoulos asks anybody who becomes a minister or secretary general or anything else to leave behind their uniforms and become like civilians. Ioannidis very smartly says, I'll stay on to keep an eye on the rest. And he keeps his uniform, he goes around in a military jeep and all this. And also he becomes the kind of the rallying center for all the younger generation that became more and more angry about corruption, about the lifestyle of Papadopoulos and his people and all that. And he plays the game very smartly. I mean, he gains the confidence of Papadopoulos by being the gatekeeper and the informer, the chief informer and all that, and the chief enforcer as well, because he had the military police. He was the guy who was in charge of the torturing, and gathering information among the distant officers and so on. And I think basically Papadopoulos has completely lost control of the army by 73, I would say.
Okay, thanks. We have a question here from Shanshal Chakraborty. What role did the United States Vice President Spiros Agnew play, if any, during this period? How relevant was he on U.S. policy?
Okay, Agnew is very important because he's the chief cheerleader, of course, for the Junta, being a Greek-American. The Junta plays a very, very smart game. Early on, when the Greek embassy refuses to see Papadopoulos after the king leaves, and despite the CIAs and the Pentagon's urging to like actually meet with Papadopoulos, warm up to him, they're very negative about it, and the State Department as well. And Papadopoulos does something very smart. He finds this Greek-American guy, this famous Greek-American businessman, Tom Pappas, who is a fundraiser for the Republican Party. He's a key supporter of Nixon during the campaign. And he's also the key man who helps Agnew, a fellow Greek-American, get the vice president's job. So the two of them make a very powerful lobby in the White House, and they steer Nixon and Kissinger, of course, actually agrees with them for very different reasons, to support the Junta and to eliminate any kind of objection or doubt about it. So I think Agnew is very important. And also he's very important because when he actually comes to Greece, this is the vice president of the United States, and he comes in a very isolated country back then. I mean, no European politician would come to Greece during the Junta. There were very few people coming from some African countries. So all of a sudden, the U.S. vice president comes, he meets with Papadopoulos, he's of course greeted as a hero, he goes to his ancestral village in the Peloponnese and all this, and that kind of is the climax in terms of the decorum of the relationship between the U.S. and the Junta. So in a sense, I think he was very important, even though I have to say that Nixon himself became a true believer in supporting the Junta after a while. But I think Agnew was instrumental in that transition period.
Okay, thanks. A question from Takis Ioakimidis, emeritus professor from the University of Athens, who I'm sure we both know very well. What were the historic mistakes committed by President Makarios, which in a direct or indirect way facilitated the coup in 1974 and eventually the Turkish invasion of Cyprus? So to what extent was there some culpability on the part of Makarios?
Well, I don't really want to go into the role that Makarios played before the 74 events. I mean, I personally think that his role in some instances was fateful because he was never clear, what his goal was. Was it the Gnosis or was it independence? And I think he went back and forth in a very Byzantine game that didn't really help the cause, let's put it that way. Now, the big mystery to me is, A, why is that, you know, even though everybody warned him about the possibility of a coup or an assassination attempt by Ioannidis, why didn't he take this seriously? This kind of, I don't know, I don't have an answer to this. I guess he had survived this so many times in the past that, you know, he thought he was invincible. And the other thing is, why, I mean, when he actually wrote this letter saying to Ioannidis, who he knew personally, and he knew that Ioannidis was a Bakarios hater with a passion, he writes his letter to him saying, I want all the Greek officers to leave Cyprus. I mean, he knew very well that this was like asking Ioannidis to commit suicide. I mean, this would have been the biggest humiliation. He would have been overthrown the next day had he done this. Now, why did he do that? Why did he push things to the brink and ignore, again, all the warnings by, you know, friends and even enemies sometimes, you know, about what was going on? I don't know. I mean, I mean, other people who were very involved in history back then, like the then King Constantine, he told me in an interview that, you know, when Makarios sent him the letter that he was going to send to Ioannidis, he opened it up, he read it and said, my God, I mean, you know, if you actually send this, you know, they're going to really overthrow you, and then we're going to go into a huge adventure. And he even calls Karmalis and, you know, warns Karmalis about that and tells, you know, we have to do something about it. But Makarios ignored all of them. Why? I guess he was in his comfort zone, you know, and, you know, once a survivor for so long, you know, you don't take these things seriously, I guess.
Okay. There's a question from John Kitmer, who is chair of the Anglo-Hellenic League here in the UK, and of course you'll know him as former ambassador for the UK in Athens. He asks, in your research, have you been able to shine new light on British reactions to and behaviour around the events on Cyprus in 1973-74? So it's a very broad question, but have you found new evidence about British reactions to events in Cyprus in 73-74?
I wouldn't say anything really earth-shaking. I think there's been a lot of research on the British archives and so on. The only thing that surprised me was that meeting between Ioannidis and the British ambassador, which actually Kissinger refers to. So obviously Callaghan had informed Kissinger about this this meeting. This is something I didn't know before. I didn't know that it had happened. Other than that, no, I wouldn't really say that I have found something that is really, you know, new or revealing in that sense.
Okay. Yet another professor, Professor Dimitris Papadimitriou from the University of Manchester. Do you share Andreas Papandreou's view that the events of 1974 constituted a premeditated treason?
No. I don't think Ioannidis can be accused of treason in the sense that, you know, he was part of a premeditated plan. No, I don't see that. I think that this was, of course, he fell into various traps that, you know, some of them he had set up for himself. Some of them were set up by the Turks. I would say to some extent the US, but still, I don't think this was a premeditated plan. I think this was a series of mistakes. I think that, you know, Ioannidis made the most of mistakes, actually, and he is to be blamed. But I don't think he was a conscious part of a premeditated plan. The only thing I would say is that the only thing that you can say, well, it's not premeditated, but it went according to script. If you go back to 64, the Turks threatened to invade Cyprus. Johnson sends them a letter saying, don't you dare do this. And the Turks stop. 67, something happens against Cyprus. The Turks again say, we're going to invade. Cyrus Vance comes. Yes, again, says, don't do it. They don't do it. Of course, Greece pays a price because they pull out their troops. Now, in my first book, there's this famous meeting in like the end of 67, December of 67. Cy Vance was like a legendary figure in the State Department, the foreign policy establishment. He says very clearly, and everybody's around the table, He says, okay, we start in 64, we start in 67. Now, if there's another mistake by the Greeks or the Cypriots or I don't know who else, we're not going to stop it the third time. There's no way we're going to stop the Turks a third time. So this was, I think, part of the U.S. foreign policy DNA, that they couldn't afford to alienate Turkey for a third time, and, you know, they would just let it happen. I think this was very clear.
Okay. The Richards also asks a question about the Cyprus file, which is allegedly kept in a wardrobe at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And he wonders whether you have an idea of what it might consist of.
Well, there are two things. One is all the Greek archives around 74 are still considered classified. I have no idea why that is. I mean, I've asked every prime minister and foreign minister for the last 20 years, and I don't get a convincing answer. I think it's, you know, it's high time that we open those up. I think some of them have come out through memoirs or, you know, oral histories and so on. There's still some stuff in there which I guess might be essential. The other part is there were two investigations by the parliament on this. One was very serious. It was in the 80s. And a lot of people were called, including Ioannidis and Papadopoulos and others. About, I guess, half or two-thirds of it has been declassified. And it's coming out, actually, in some official publication by the parliament. The rest is not. I think what you're going to see there is some people talking about their the contacts they had with the Americans, the CIA agents, and so on. From what I know and from what I've seen and from what I've heard, there's nothing really more revealing than has already come out. I don't think there's anything, you know, much more to this. And one thing I have to say, which is really incredible, is that in a way, you know, we're very lucky that we have the British and the US archives, because, you know, a lot of light has been centered on Greek history by those, because unfortunately we don't have a very strong tradition of keeping our archives either intact or, you know, open.
Tell me. Dennis McShane asks, a former minister for Europe in the UK, let me put a question back. I wonder if you have any views on the memory of the ousting of George Papandreou in the 1945-46 period and Churchill's determination to restore the monarchy. Other nations in Europe used the end of German occupation to move their countries into a social democratic modernization phase with some center-right support. Was this moment lost for Greece and therefore a forerunner of the events of 1967? And let me pause there.
Well, that's a complicated question. I think that, first of all, there was a split, I think, between the US and the UK on this. The US was very much against the restoration of the monarchy. I mean, after all, the people in charge of foreign policy back then, they were new dealers who just despised anything that had to do with monarchy or any kind of, you know, such European tradition. I think Churchill... I think he saw the whole affair in a very emotional way, perhaps because of the close ties between the Greek and the British monarchy. I think that played actually a very important role. And I think, you know, the anti-communist thing took over after a while. I mean, it was so important for Britain and later on the US, not initially, to win the war against the communists, that they thought the king was somebody who could unite and rally the people in that cause, you know, for the West against the Eastern Bloc.
Okay. Dennis McShane also asked a question about the UK in relation to Cyprus in 1974. Could the UK have done more by moving troops from the sovereign bases in Cyprus as a kind of tripwire to at least contain the Turkish invasion and the first assault? I guess it goes back to what you were saying about Callaghan and the Suez legacy.
I think this was seriously considered by Callaghan and the British government, and I think it was seriously discussed. I think Callaghan, in a phone call, mentions this to Kissinger. Kissinger really goes ballistic over this, and in different meetings, that we have the transcripts of, he really rails against Callahan, saying, you know, what the hell are these guys doing? They're out of their league. I don't believe they're doing this. He's really, you know, he's really going against that. And I think Kissinger, in a very clear way, sent the message, you know, if you do this, you're going to be on your own. We're going to abandon you, you know, with whatever that meant for that time. But I think this was seriously considered.
Okay, thank you.
And it played a small role in preventing the Turks from occupying the whole airport, actually. This was the only critical moment when British forces actually played the role.
Zakalotis asks, during your research, did you find any evidence that the military junta advised or warned the United States about the planned coup in Cyprus? And if so, what was the reaction of the United States at that point? So did Washington know about the coup? And you've touched on this already.
Yeah, well, actually what happens is there are all kinds of warnings coming to Washington. The CIA actually sends a cable saying Ioannidis is probably going to move with a coup against Makarios. Some people at the State Department, most famous one being Tom Boyett, who was the Cyprus desk officer, actually sends a memo, says we have to do something about it. They don't get Kissinger's attention, but at least Sisko, who was the number two or three, I guess, then, calls up the American embassy in Greece and tells them, you know, you better find out somebody in charge and tell them that this is a bad idea. For some reason, the American ambassador refused to see the Ioannidis, and Ioannidis then refused to see him as well. He said, you know, he better talk to the prime minister, who was kind of a joker back then. And then in the end, this ends up in a demarche to the Cyprus desk officer at the Greek foreign minister. So I think that the US had a lot of signals that the coup was going to happen, a lot of signals. I think there was a complete failure by them not to do something about it. And Tom Boyett explains all this in a famous dissent memorandum he wrote in September of 74, and he paid with his career for that at that point. And then what happens, of course, is after the system wakes up, Ioannidis decides to play his own game. And he sends a proxy, a guy who was the head of the raiding forces, who had the liaison with the CIA then, and tells the Americans, well, Ioannidis changed his mind. He's not going to move against Makarios. And this is incredible because on the day of the coup, Tom Boyett, this critic of Kissinger and the U.S. policy, you know, he comes to the State Department as a Cyprus desk officer. They wake him up, you know, in the middle of the night, and he comes there, and there's a national intelligence estimate saying there's a coup going to happen against Makarios. And then there's a cable saying, actually, Ioannidis changed his mind. He's not going to move against Makarios. And the guy says, obviously, we were sucked in by this.
Thank you. Professor Yorgos Kazemias from the University of Cyprus. Why do you think it is that the orders of Ioannidis at the beginning of the crisis actually failed to materialize?
I think that, first of all, I think that Ioannidis had basically disappointed everybody because he had told them so many times before the invasion started, don't worry, nothing is going to happen. The Turks will never move. Once the Turks started moving, they lost confidence in him. And a lot of them were ready, you know, from a long time before, like Arapakis, the head of the Navy and others, to move against him. They just found the opportunity to do this. And then I think, you know, some of them, they were actually convinced by the U.S. to go against it. So basically they ignored his orders. Some others were scared, clearly scared that there was going to be a second front in the Aegean and that this was going to be a catastrophe, a Greek-Turkish war and a catastrophe for Greece. And he had completely lost his nerve and he has lost his leverage. A lot, you know, some of the people around him described to me in interviews, they went up to him and they said, why didn't you shoot some of the generals? And, you know, go and make sure that you give this or the other order for sending planes or troops or something like this. But the guy had disappeared and he was really fading very fast. I mean, it was a complete implosion. That's how they described it to me.
Thank you. Back to Takis Ioakimidis, who says, what's your view of Karamanlis's decision to withdraw Greece from the military wing of NATO?
Well, if you look back at it, I mean, policy, foreign policy point of view, was a mistake, because clearly Greece lost, you know, some of the privileges it had in the Aegean, and mainly in the Aegean, during this time when it withdrew itself from the military part, because Turkey clearly took advantage of that. Politically, he was in a very tight spot. I mean, he knew that anti-Americanism was really, you know, going nuts at that point. He knew Andreas was going to criticize him very heavily if he didn't do anything. And he was very influenced, of course, by the French, who had done the same before. So for him, I guess it was a one-way street, you know. Either he had to, like, shut down a couple of the US bases, which he considered doing, but, you know, he thought it was too drastic, or to, you know, do this with NATO. Clearly, it was a mistake. I think a few people told him that, especially some diplomats. But he thought that was the only way he could deal with the problem.
Thank you. There's a question from Bruce Clark, notable Phil Helene and British journalist.
And an author of a great book on Athens, I have to say.
Absolutely. Is there any evidence that any highly placed or even medium-ranking American actually encouraged Ioannidis to overthrow Makarios, as opposed to failing to discourage him?
I have my suspicions about this, but this, as I said, I don't think we're ever going to find a clear black and white record. There's this famous CIA guy named Gas Avrakotos. Gas Avrakotos was a Greek-American. He was in Greece in the 60s. He was very friendly with Papadopoulos. He knew Ioannidis personally and others. Spoke Greek. He was as nationalistic as they were. He hated Andreas. He hated Makarios. Now, he has told a U.S. journalist in another context the famous story. The Johnson administration was very worried about Andreas Papandreou being executed. So after, you know, they realized they couldn't really get the message to Papadopoulos through the embassy and the official channels, they flew him from, I think it was Vietnam, they flew him to Athens to tell Papadopoulos not to execute Andreas. So, you know, the guy reads the talking points from the CIA, and then in his own narrative, he tells Papadopoulos, don't worry about this crap I just read to you, go ahead and kill the bastard. Papadopoulos ignored his advice, of course, and Andreas, you know, fled to Europe and then to Canada. But this same guy, he was the guy who was talking to Ioannidis before the coup against Makarios. And even though, you know, we have all these descriptions and the cables and so on, saying that, you know, this guy has told me, you know, don't do it, the Turks are going to move, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I have some suspicions, but I don't really know whether Avrakotos met with Ioannidis in some suburb or in a cafe near the military headquarters and told him, you know what, just go ahead, kill the bastard being Makarios this time around, and the U.S. will not do anything. Now, was this authorized by Kissinger or the CIA or somebody like this? I don't think so. I'm not sure, but I don't think so. There's no evidence about this. I think that the U.S. was pretty happy with Makarios at that point. They were pretty comfortable with him. But Ioannidis had no clue whether, you know, the stuff that this guy was telling him informally was an official signal or not. I mean, the guy was completely clueless about this. I think Avrakotos is a critical guy. Unfortunately, we never got, you know, for him to, you know, to tell his story. But I think he's a crucial guy, and probably he has taken these secrets, you know, to his grave along with Ioannidis.
Back to the Cyprus situation, Professor Robert MacDonald from the University of London, one of our most prominent historians of Cyprus, asks the question, were Grivas and Samson independent agents?
I think they were. I think that Grivas was clearly an independent agent back from the 50s on. He was very good in manipulating Greek public opinion and the Cypriot public opinion in many ways. And I think that he took a sort of mythical role upon himself, which was very convincing at the time and very intimidating, actually. And even though a lot of the Greek veteran diplomats back then warned about his role and the risk of his adventures and so on. I don't think anybody could really do anything about it. And it's one of the mysteries, of course, to me was when Grivas goes back to Cyprus in 72, I believe, was he sent by Papadopoulos? Did he escape from Greece and went to Cyprus? The more I have looked into this, the more I realize that Grivas had become a threat to Papadopoulos because he was respected within the nationalistic function of the army. Mm. He was a pro-monarchist, and I think probably he was conveniently led to escape to Cyprus. And then when Ioannidis comes in, of course, Ioannidis is very close to Grivas. I mean, he loves Grivas. He loves what, you know, Grivas aspires to. They have the common enemy, Makarios, and so on. And therefore, you know, the organization that Grivas creates late in his life, the Oka Vita, is clearly part of the Greek intelligence and Ioannidis' master plan.
Thank you. Another professor, Michalis Haliassos from the Goethe University in Frankfurt. Did you find any evidence that the junta had squandered defense funds or generally underinvested in defense, thus making an intervention even less likely to succeed in 1974?
That's actually a very interesting question because, yes, I mean, the Greek junta had underinvested in the first few years. Then about 72 to 73, they decided to make quite a heavy investment. And they buy some modern US airplanes, they buy some submarines and so on. And also Ioannidis, after the oil discoveries, when he first comes into power, he decides to spend a huge amount for a time on a new kind of armaments, some of them from France. And this was kind of leverage against the US again. I think the big mistake, of course, was they completely miscalculated when these new systems were going to be ready to use. For example, they bought this famous F-4s, which were very modern. Turkey didn't have them. And they were the first planes that could actually go to Cyprus, execute an operation there, like bomb, like a landing armada or something like this, and come back to Greece. Because up to that point, the only thing the Greek planes could do, the older generation, was go do something, you know, like an operation there, and then they either had to crash land in the sea, probably, you know, losing some pilots, or go to Beirut, another airport, and land there. The big problem was that, you know, these new planes, even though they had them for a few months, and you know, they weren't ready. I mean, they weren't ready for such a complicated operation. The pilots weren't ready, the infrastructure were not there, the bases in Crete, which were the only ones that, you know, could accommodate such a mission, weren't ready. And that was a big blunder.
Thank you. There's a question from Theodoros Gotsis, Consul General of Cyprus in the UK. He wants to follow up on the question posed by Professor Takis Ioakimidis regarding the responsibility of President Makarios. Can the answer be that Makarios felt that he was really at the peak of his power in 1974, after the internal developments in Cyprus, as well as regarding his relations regionally and internationally at the time? So in essence, it was a misinterpretation of his leverage that led Makarios to think that he could have a showdown with Ioannidis.
I completely agree with that assessment. It was a complete miscalculation and it was almost hubris. I mean, he was at the peak of his power. He had finally struck a very good working relationship with the U.S. And I think that played a very important role in his own mind because, you know, he was thinking, if I'm okay with the U.S., if the U.S. has warned me in the past about the possible assassination attempt on me and they have actually averted this, then I would be okay. I mean, no Greek would ever think of doing something like this. And I think he was really carried away by it.
Thank you very much. I think we're coming to the end of time, Alexis. Let me thank you very, very much indeed for covering so many questions. I apologize to those who are watching that I didn't have the chance to get to their questions. Let me remind the audience that this events is being recorded, and the podcast will be available on the web pages of the LSE's Hellenic Observatory as soon as we can manage that. I think the discussion, Alexis's account of his book in particular, will be a wonderful resource for many students and academics looking at the history of this period. Before we close, can I mention that the next events of the Hellenic Observatory will have a very different topic. It will be looking at the labour market in Greece, and we have Professor Alan Manning, Professor of Economics and the Director of the Community Programme at the Centre for Economic Performance here at the London School of Economics. And he will give a lecture on minimum wages, lessons for Greece from the international experience. As you can see on your screens, that will be on Tuesday, the 7th of December at 4 p.m. UK time, 6 p.m. Greek time. And we look forward to you joining us for that event. Again, let me thank everyone for the questions, wonderful interventions, and let me thank Alexis Papahellas for joining us for this discussion about his new book, A Dark Room. Thank you very much indeed, and we look forward to seeing you on the next occasion.